A prayer. Father, open your word that we may understand it, and may our lives be receptive to your word in the name of Christ. Amen. Well, the Apostle Paul tells us that Jesus loved the church so much that he gave his life for it. That's a pretty substantial kind of love. Actually, in the book that John Pritchard wrote, Living Jesus, that we're using as a sort of loose framework for some of these sermons, the title that John Pritchard gives to this chapter is Jesus Crazy About the Church. Now, from most of our experience of the church, we're saying, what is there to be crazy about? In fact, what is there to love about it? All those committees, all that moralizing that goes on, and all those dull services that you have to attend week by week. What is there to love about the church? I remember when I was a young boy, sort of smiling smugly when I heard that little suggestion, if everyone that fell asleep in church was laid end to end, they'd be a lot more comfortable. What is there to love about the church? Why is it even suggested that Jesus might be crazy about the church? Well, perhaps there's a problem there with thinking about the nature of love. You see, love isn't really, sincere and genuine love, isn't given because of some characteristic of the person who receives it. Love is given in such a generous way that embraces whoever the other is, and it is love that inspires the one who is loved to be what it can be. And that's the sense, I think, in which we need to think about. Jesus loved the church. He loved it with such a desire that he gave it the freedom to be all that it could possibly be. Now, what is the church? Well, Bishop John says it didn't start out very well. It was a small band of shell-shocked disciples who had just witnessed the death of the one they had been following for more than 3 years. And yet within just 30 years, this thing called the church had spread across all of what we now know as modern-day Turkey. It had impacted most of Greece, and it had reached even as far as Rome. The word church is interesting, and John Pritchard mentions this. It comes from a Greek word, which basically is a gathering of people who have been called together by a herald. A church is a gathering of people who've been called together. It's as if there was a trumpet call, a bit like the bells that sound over our church every Sunday, calling people together. But of course, it's not the bells that call us. It's that love of Jesus that invites us into this presence, to be all that we can be. And one of the questions I want to leave with you this morning is it a sufficient response to that call of Jesus to just gather for an hour once a week? Is that enough? Is that as much as we can give in response to the love that was so generous that Jesus called us and died for us? Of course, we say it, but we don't always believe it. The word church isn't the building. It isn't these stones and wood that surrounds us. It's the people that are present when we gather. That's perhaps what's the church. So the first thing I want to say about the church is it's a community of people who've heard the call and come rushing into the presence of Jesus in order to enjoy his love. Now, there are two dangers with this, of course. One is that those who gather think we're rather privileged. And it's very easy for us to kind of domesticate the story about Jesus and make it our own private kind of story to celebrate and follow. And what happens when you domesticate the story of Jesus is, of course, as Bishop John says in his book, you end up with a foam rubber Christianity, a safe landing, a place that's comfortable to be, rather than a place where, a place where we treat Jesus as a friendly pet rather than an untamed tiger. It reminds me of the line in The Witch in the Wardrobe when Lucy first talks to Mr. Beaver about Aslan. You remember what Lucy was concerned was, is this lion safe? And you remember Mr. Beaver says, safe? Who said anything about being safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he is good. When we gather, there's a danger that we just want a safe and comfortable place where we can celebrate this love of Jesus. And domesticating him is one danger. The other danger, of course, is that we do make it exclusive. Only we have the right story. Only we tell it in the right way. Only we practice it in the right way. And that can be very exclusive and lead others who have come to that story in different ways and who want to celebrate the experience in different ways. And in some ways, to be exclusive about it is to betray the nature of the story that we have inherited, the story we've received. You see, God's love comes wrapped in stories, not in dogma. So we listen to stories, and we can have many different responses to it. Think, for example, just briefly about that story we all know so well of the prodigal son. Sometimes when we hear that story, we hear in it that incredibly generous spirit of the father that permitted the son to take his heritage and go and waste it, to go out and experiment with the world and make mistakes. And that's what we hear in the story. Sometimes we hear in that story that moment, that turning in that individual's life when he'd wasted it everything. And he came to a discovery of the truth about himself in a much more profound way than he had ever known before. Sometimes we'll hear that story and it'll be that father running to meet his son, completely forgiving and forgetting everything that had passed because he wanted to embrace the son again in his family. And sometimes we'll hear that story and we'll notice particularly the brother who's uncomfortable with his father's generosity and uneasy about welcoming the son back. And we see in that something of our own self-righteousness. You see, when you hear a story, you don't hear dogma. You hear this wonderful portrayal that can be heard in so many different ways of the love of Christ that is extended to us even to the point that he died on the Son. Now, our calling as a community of those who gather around that story is to repeat the story, to remind each other of it, to celebrate it, and to probe it a little deeper to find out what its truth might mean for us here and now. But as we let the seed fall, it'll fall on lots of different soil, and it'll produce many different reactions, and it challenges us to recognize that it seeks to embrace all, whoever they may be, all who respond, however different they are from us. You see, one of the basic characteristics of the church that Jesus is crazy about is what some people have called, it's an impossible community. Young and old, people of all races, of all sexualities, of all kinds and traditions and backgrounds are embraced in this story and welcome in this place. That hasn't always been true of this building and the people who met here. I don't know whether you saw the article in the Friends magazine by Roger Barnes recently about this church in the mid-19th century. And a man who made quite a significant contribution to this church, that screen in the back there used to be up here in front of the chapel. He brought it in from Magdalen College. And these candle holders were also something that he brought in. But the church in those days wasn't laid out like this. Down here on the North Isle, as I understand Roger's article, there were just empty benches for the poor to come and just sort of sit. And the men were back there in the west end of the church in a gallery. Only here in the center were the boxed pews where the more prosperous members of this village could come and worship. And up there in the chancel were boxed pews for guess who? Farley's own family. They had the privileged seats. Apparently Farley conducted the services. It didn't matter who was there anyway. And there was a lot of sort of smoking and noise and commotion that went on during those services. It wasn't exactly what I've been describing as a place that embraced all in the love of Christ. It's an interesting question. Have we made any progress since then? And is it a good direction to have taken? Well, in the gradual, we sang this song about welcoming all. And I'd like us to just actually pick up that notice sheet again and sing, just to remind us at this point in the sermon, of what I'm saying in the words that, as they're expressed here in the last verse. Let us build a house where all are named, their songs and visions heard. Let's just, as we're sitting, just if Ruth can lead us, we'll sing that again, just that last verse. Well, there are two consequences of that inclusion of everyone. One is that as a community of God's followers, we are witnesses to the reconciliation that God has won for the world in Jesus Christ. And the second, which I think we sometimes miss, is that this context, this situation, is a place that can confront all of our arrogance and hubris, knock the rough edges off of our personalities, challenge our egos, and turn us into people who are more desirous of following Jesus Christ. But what is, or who is, the church for? Well, you may have noticed, or may have heard, that at 3:30 on Friday afternoon, the doors of St. Paul's Cathedral were closed to the public, for health and safety reasons, apparently. I haven't been down there, so I have no idea what the circumstances are, but I'm sure that the people who run the church were being sensible in trying to protect that national treasure. But it does seem to be rather contrary to the nature of our national cathedral that it should no longer be a place that is open to the public. You see, the church, someone has suggested, and I've found different sources of this quotation, so I won't reference any of them, but the church is the one institution on earth that exists for the benefit of its non-members. So while we actually gather in response to the call of Christ, we gather not for our own interests and purposes, but for the rest of the world. And so a church with open doors is the best symbol of that embracing of all and a desire to be a part of it. And there's several reasons for that. I'll just summarize them briefly and then bring this sermon to a close. The first is that the church is the one place that provides an alternative story to the prevailing culture of our day. So it's a place that can comment and critique the prevailing assumptions of our world. No one else can do it like the church. And we should be living lives that are constantly challenging and critiquing the prevailing ways of thinking about and living in the world. Of course, sometimes some church leaders allow it to descend into rather second-rate politics, but it's not that we're a political institution, but that we are a body of people who are living by a different story to the story that prevails in our contemporary culture. And that goes on to suggest that actually, as we tell that story outside of our doors to the wider society, it gives people a chance of framing their own experiences in the light of that story. I want to venture to suggest that most people have experiences of God. They just don't know how to label it. They don't understand what the experience is. And so they either brush it aside or they go chasing the latest spiritual guru for an explanation. The church should be speaking aloud, proclaiming to the world its own story, because this story will help everyone else who has an experience of God to understand what has happened. There is a role for the church on behalf of society to remind the world that there is a moral order and that our actions have consequences. That is an important task. You see, the church is not primarily, although the church is not primarily, and the Christian faith isn't primarily about being virtuous, it's about learning how to be human. And one of the characteristics of learning how to be human is to come to terms with the fact that we're sinners. That's the call that we bring into the world and why we stand for moral principle. And the world also needs to be offered hope. And it's our privilege and responsibility to be particularly there when people fail, when people drop off the edge, when they can't keep up with the system. And it's perhaps that compassionate expression of our life together that works itself out into the wider society that is the witness that we should be to the world. During the 20th century, the welfare state took over most of the work of the church. It might have been a good step forward. There are more resources that have been thrown into looking after those who are disadvantaged and ill than would have been possible by the church. But as we know, the welfare state is under threat, and the current economic climate is removing services from the welfare state, and the gaps are opening up, into which the church again, hopefully, will rush. Because as an expression of the story that we live by is our compassionate concern for those who are in need. Perhaps during the 20th century, when the welfare state was so successful, the church was reduced to words. And now we have a chance to get back involved in deeds again. So the call to gather, which is the principal call, is the call of Christ that who loves us to be in his presence. But it's a call that then sends us out into the world to make a difference in the world. Incidentally, making a difference in the world is the theme of living faith that we will be dealing with next year. So we need the church. We need the church because together, as we gather, and as we tell our story to one another, we brush off against each other and our arrogance and hubris is challenged. We need the church because it's a demonstration to the world of the reconciling power of Christ, and it provides a framework within which society can right its wrongs and begin to live as God intended all humanity to live. This is a high calling. Can you hear that call to community? What one thing do you think we could do to move further into fulfilling that call as a community here in Ducklington? And can we fulfill the calling just gathering for an hour every week? Amen.